I won't start until the people scream. Thank you. Welcome. This is the Atheist Experience. I don't know if one of us has our earbuds, but I got a little ring. Hey, we're live. This is the Atheist Experience. Today is November 4th, 2018, which means in the United States, we are 2 days away from midterm elections. Vote.
Vote.
Vote your happy little asses off. I want all of you to vote as long as you're voting for the people that I want to win. And that's just the way it's going to be. So, how you doing?
Good.
I'm Matt Delaney hosting, but Dawn Baker has joined me here again.
Good to be here as always.
And you have a topic to discuss.
I do.
But before we get to it, there's some business to get out of the way. I have regular announcements, and then I have a correction, an apology, an explanation, and a fuck you. in that order.
In that order.
But quickly, the monthly newsletter for the Atheist Community of Austin has just gone out. It includes an article that Dawn wrote.
Yes. I got a little column that I'm adding that is terms that atheists should be familiar with.
Cool. This program is sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin, a nonprofit educational organization promoting positive atheism and the separation of religion and government. You can find out more about the ACA at atheist-community.org, but also hit up the social media outlets. That's where you're going to find the monthly newsletter, etc. Oh, and by the way, in 2 days, you should go vote. I'll remind you about that again. Just don't vote for the people that I don't want to win. I'm going to remind you of that again, too. If you'd like to know who I'd like to vote for, you can email me privately, and I will tell you how I would prefer that you vote, because we won't do that on the show. So, another special announcement today, right after the Atheist Experience, as we've done in previous weeks, we will be doing the second launch or the premiere launch, something or other, for Parenting Beyond Belief. And tonight it's going to be, Claire and Dale McGowan and Kendall Hopkins will all be on the show. It's a call-in show tonight. So as soon as we're done, right around 6 o'clock or so, Dawn and I will vanish from the studio and new people will come in for a new show about parenting. Something I highly recommend. The Atheist Community of Austin's doing a great job producing more and more shows, not only Atheist Experience and let's see, what are the others? Oh, who cares? We're here for the Atheist Experience. Oh, no. Atheist Experience, Talk Heathen, Nonprofits, Godless Bitches, Parenting Beyond Belief, Secular Sexuality, Truth Wanted, Mr. Atheist, and there's 72 more, I think, right now.
I can't keep track.
I don't know, but it's awesome because, as I mentioned before, we've moved beyond just having the sorts of, you know, arguments and colon to addressing the whole person. It's, holy cow, one might say that the Atheist Community of Austin is becoming more humanist.
Maybe so.
Maybe. Putting the kind in humankind.
We have a lot of articulate, intelligent folks that have something to say, and that's all good stuff.
Yeah, and excited about all those efforts. But today, I have to start with what happened on the show 2 weeks ago when I was on. And during the first caller, I made a factual mistake about the Bible. And I was a complete jackass about it too. The caller had meandered a bit and decided that he wanted to cite a Bible verse to back up his claim. The Bible verse doesn't back up his claim, even when you get it right. But it was, you know, the way, the truth, and the life. And I, for some reason in my head, said this guy's wrong about everything, so he has to be wrong about this. And so I corrected him that it wasn't the way, the truth, and the life. I said it was the way, the truth, and the light, and stressed it, and then hung up on him and told him he needed to go study his Bible. Well, as it turns out, I'm the one that needed to go study my Bible. So my apologies to him. He got that verse right, although I don't think it affected the substance of the argument at all. It's not the end of the day. By the way, it's not the first mistake I've made. It wasn't the first mistake I've made in that show. It won't be the only mistake I make. I'll probably make some today. But, you know, try and acknowledge it. And when you've been a jackass, just say, you know, hey, I was a jackass. Now, there was another caller a little later in the show named Sam. And there were three people, at least, maybe four, who emailed to say that I just was completely mean to Sam. I disagree. I was certainly in an irritable mood, but when somebody calls in to basically tell you that you're doing it wrong and then they agree with you when you cite things like, you know, hey, you got it wrong on this, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. And then I read her the actual passage from Exodus and she agrees. But the big point that she started in on was this notion of why are you guys spending time on Hebrews 11:1? Because it's an oxymoron. And all I did, if you go back and watch the call, is I started by saying, please explain to me how this is an oxymoron because I don't get that. And I was going to go from there to, even if it is an oxymoron, that doesn't change whether or not we should address it. But we never really got there because despite pointing out that this is the single most commonly referenced verse that Christians use to talk about faith, and so therefore we have to kind of address it, it just wasn't going anywhere. And I got a little snotty. I think it was mostly deserved, perhaps not as deserved as other people did, and so I will exercise some caution then. But to the people who think that mistakes like that, to the extent that they are mistakes, are destroying the atheist movement. Fuck you. Everybody's going to make mistakes. And on a live show, especially when I've got multiple callers here, things happen a little differently than they do at the debate. I just posted yesterday, went live with two different debates, one with John Ferrer that I did on morality a week or so ago at Texas A&M University. It all went well. When you have interlocutors that care about the conversation, you can have a good conversation, and there are countless good calls. Not every call is good. And if you write in to tell me I was mean to somebody, and then your defense of them is that you think maybe that person was a little drunk and confused, well, don't call the damn show if you're drunk and confused, because I'm not going to take it easy on you. When you tell me I'm factually wrong about something and I was right, I'm going to make sure that I point that out. Just like when I was factually wrong, I corrected that today too. So my apologies to the first caller, a mild quasi-apology to the other caller who might may or may not be
bothered. We used to have a sign that said skepticism is a virtue, and
yeah.
I still like the sign, but we meant that to apply to us too.
Yeah.
And I make mistakes and screw up all the time. And
we've corrected each other live on the air. I mean, yeah. It's mistake's not the end
you
of the world.
You more than me.
Well, no, the mistake's not the end of the world. The end of the world is when you are so attached to your position and your opinion of your position that you turn into a jackass, which I did at the end of the first call. But the real problem is not correcting that. And so if that caller wants to call back in, just tell the call screener. We'll be happy to start over from scratch, and I will try to talk a little bit more about where we agree and where I disagree.
Sounds good.
I don't know that I have any other. Oh, wait. Vote in 2 days, as long as you're not voting for people that I don't want to win.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's we right had there. A very big atheist turnout the last election, and that's kind of sad to me.
Lastly, the monthly speaker series is coming up, and you can find out more information about that on social media. I know Aaron Ross is the guest speaker this time, so if he's making the trip down from Dallas, surely everybody in Texas, well, maybe not El Paso, but everybody on this side of Texas can make their way down to the speaker's event. That is all I have, Don.
Okay.
I'm going to turn it over to you, where you can tell us something important.
I'll try to. Today I wanted to talk about RFRA, which is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And there are there is a national one, a federal one, and there are various state ones. And the gist of the Texas one is it provides that a government agency may not substantially burden a person's free exercise of religion unless the government agency demonstrates that the application of the burden to the person is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and the least restrictive means of furthering that interest. And so,
boy, that's worded in such a way that there could be loads and loads of arguments about what that means.
I think so. I personally think that these are terrible laws, really, really bad. And unfortunately, they were bipartisan. They were started out as being, hey, these guys want to smoke peyote for their, you know, Indian thing, you know, and we shouldn't interfere with that. And so they made this very broad law to address this very narrow problem, and all the states jumped on board, and it seems to have a flavor of a creeping religious favoritism in my mind, and that's kind of what I want to address today. The Texas law supposedly has provisions to ensure that RFRA can't be misused to disregard civil rights protections against discrimination. Let's see.
By the way, might be the case that you're going to get to this. The referral laws get used for all kinds of things, and I agree with you that it's this creeping religious privilege that we're seeing a lot, mm-hmm. you know, right up to people refusing to fill prescriptions and things like that on religious grounds.
Yeah, that's very scary.
But isn't this also perpetuating a cycle? The language that you just read about protected classes, because RFRA's law, now we have to go around and add more and more protected classes so that they are not getting trampled all over by RFRA. And then when we add more protected classes, that affects other things. So there's a cascade effect to these things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right. The folks suing, which is kind of the point I want to get to here in Austin, they are looking to have various other laws amended so that they get special privilege under this RFRA law. Yeah. It's kind of a creeping thing that just keeps going. And my problem with this is it tends to put religious belief over what the government would normally do. And we've had precedents like the Hobby Lobby decision where they have sort of said, well, it's not the government's place to decide what's a valid religious belief or whether it, you know, whatever. And it doesn't have to be a core belief. It doesn't have to be written down. It can be pretty much any wackadoodle thing you want to believe. And now the government has to kowtow and work around that.
There's an interesting point in there. I had an argument with a lawyer who was working for American Atheists at the time because I thought I found a way that we could tax the churches.
Okay.
Because if the statement that you just talked about the government shouldn't be in the position of defining what is a religion and what is not a religion. And yet that is absolutely what has to happen. If the government is going to determine that religions are tax exempt, the government then has to define what religions are for that purpose.
Or at least make the decision on a one-by-one, case-by-case basis to give tax exemptions, right?
But we need some sort of criteria.
Right.
And what that does is that means that now, if you have a thing that you think is a religion that you think should get a tax-exempt status, you now have to essentially petition the government and prove that you're a religion. When we wanted property tax exemptions for the ACA or something different, there were other organizations, other religious organizations in Austin who had fought for that before. I remember the Buddhist temple had to basically prove that they should qualify as a religion.
Right.
And part of the problem with that is that there are a lot of Buddhists who say that it's not a religion. It's a philosophy.
Well, a lot of atheists that are very uncomfortable with that idea too.
Yeah. And so that means that the government has to be in this position of defining religion. And now there's an unavoidable entanglement between religion and government.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. And I think there's a more insidious part of it that really shows up here with the RFRA is that you have to be relatively well off to be able to hire lawyers and work the legal system in order to get this benefit. And that folks that are kind of a fledgling or new or have fringe beliefs, they don't have those resources. And so it tends to emphasize the folks that can, you know, suck the money out of the pews and use it for whatever they want. And so that's another problem too. It's kind of subtle. Well, this last month, there were two lawsuits, one from a group called Texas Values and another group called the U.S. Pastors Council. Both of them are really Texas groups that are nonprofit evangelical groups, and they're suing under RFRA to actively discriminate against gays and transgender people, specifically saying the Federal Rights Act Civil Rights Act doesn't apply to people who have religious beliefs. And in particular, they're going after an Austin city council ordinance that protects lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer folks from employment discrimination. And the claims that these folks are making are really sort of saying, well, if you're a Christian business, whatever that means, you don't have to hire these folks and you need to have a special exemption from that. It's not just, you know, the churches wanting an exemption for themselves. They're sort of trying to cast a wider net. And that's one of the creeping aspects of this. And these are the same two groups that along with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and Greg Abbott in the last legislative session were pushing for the bathroom bills to make sure that people had the right parts or the right birth certificate in public bathrooms. And it was just a silly thing. And I think it's going to come back, unfortunately. So let me give you a couple quotes from these lawsuits just so you get a flavor of what they look like. Neither of these two exemptions accommodates employers that operate in accordance with the sincerely held religious beliefs that homosexual and transgender behavior is immoral. Nor does either of these two exemptions accommodate employers who, for reasons of sincere religious belief, refuse to hire practicing homosexual or transgendered people, refuse to extend spousal benefits to same-sex partners or spouses of employees, or refuse to open their sex-specific restrooms to members of the opposite biological sex. So that's one quote. The city of Austin's anti-discrimination laws violate the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act by refusing to exempt individuals and corporate entities from that object to homosexual behavior and transgender behavior for sincere religious religion reasons. Here's a good one. Because these member churches rely on the Bible rather than modern-day cultural fads for religious and moral guidance, they will not hire practicing homosexuals or transgendered people as clergy. So this was the Pastors Council lawsuit. They also don't want to have they also want to make sure that women don't have a role over any authority over a man in their organizations and so on. It kind of creeps and creeps. So they want to substantially expand religious rights by having every new statute carve it out, having specific exemptions for their beliefs. And it seems that Christianity at its core is about power and grabbing more of it. You'd have to look long and hard to find basis for these bathroom things in the Bible. You know, it's not like Jesus spent all of his time worrying about bathrooms and which ones they were using. And a lot of this really pisses me off in the sense that so much of this is giving deference to religion, and the religious belief is pretty much any wackadoodle thing that anybody ever thought of. So clearly atheists should get in the act. And I'm here today to assert that atheists have religious beliefs too. And yeah, they happen to be more sensible in many cases, not all cases, but in many cases than those of the theists. And I wanted to say what some of my religious beliefs are, and that I may be filing something under the RFRA just to
perfect.
Poke an eye or two.
Tell us.
Okay. My sincere religious belief is that religions are mostly con games that deserve no respect or public consideration. There should not be a tax exemption just for believing in unjustified nonsense. Worshiping an invisible mass murder is a proven pathway to evil. These are my beliefs. Churches that engage in harm to others should be financially penalized and not coddled. Churches should be subject to all the same laws as any other organization. For example, if you are running a child molestation crime ring, you should be shut down under the RICO laws. Religious daycare organizations should be subject to the same laws that protect the children in secular daycare so that those other children get the same protection.
Amen. Preach.
While nonprofit status may be appropriate for some churches who are doing good works, they should file 990 forms like all other nonprofits.
Hallelujah.
Okay. The word God should be removed from money, anthems, mottos, public monuments, and government in general. And this is, deference to religion. Finally, while I'm against slavery, I strongly believe that taking Christian demagogues as slaves is entirely appropriate. And here's why. Seems like the natural use of a demagogue. It serves as an object lesson for those that want to restore Iron Age beliefs and use them as weapons. So if you want to live by that Bible, that's fine. As a slave, their money can be turned into valid secular purposes. So I'm going to get their money too as my slaves. Their bodies can be parted out to save innocent lives. Later, they can have their sex changed so that they will forever be persecuted as they have done to others. and when they return back to their communities, if so. If sold to the next atheist, they can clean toilets or whatever good might come out of the rest of their existence. So I see no problems with, I see no civil rights issue here because they want to be judged by their, they want to be, have the Bible as their moral code, and slavery is certainly supported in the Bible, and it's supported by Texas. Did you know that? Because we have a monument sitting on the Capitol grounds.
Yes.
It supports manservants and maidservants. Anyway, so evangelical pastors, please bring it on! Us atheists, we're going to start asserting our rights and through these ill-thought-out laws, and we will scare the bejesus out of them. Maybe it's a late Halloween thing, I don't know. And I'm sure that Christians will be terrified of the religious beliefs of atheists.
Probably. Okay. You know who they're going to be more terrified of?
Who's that?
Satanists. Satanists are your best friends, people.
Yeah,
Satanists working towards, you know, because rather than, you know, something Don comes up with or me inventing my own religion and having to go down that fight, Satanists are actually already out there and actively working to oppose riffer stuff. And boy, I tell you what, it's amazing the results they give, because if a church wants to come in and hand out, you know, Bible tracts at a school and the Satanists show up to hand out their tracts, all of a sudden nobody's allowed to hand out tracts,
yeah,
which is the way it should be.
Yep.
Hey, none of us get to go do that.
They've done a lot of good through their, yeah, you know,
I
need to promote their crazy shit.
I'm not a Satanist, but I will promote them left and right.
Right.
All right. On that front,
let's take some calls.
Let's take some calls. As a reminder, this is a live program sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin. The number's up at the bottom of your screen. All of our lines are full right now, but we'll do what we can to get through as many calls as we can today. We have David in Queensland. How are you?
Oh, hi. Really well, thanks, Matt. How's yourself?
I'm not too bad.
Say hi to Don as well. Thanks.
Well, hi.
You can say hi to him. You're on with both of
us.
Of course.
So did you have something for us?
Yes. Well, I've rung in because I'm a benevolent, or if you like, a controversy theist. And I just thought that might have been of interest to you.
So you believe in a God that's benevolent?
Yes, that's correct. And I also believe that at this time, benevolent God, or a God who is love, that there is a great controversy over whether this is true or not.
Well, I'll agree with you that there's a controversy, because I don't see any evidence for any God, benevolent or otherwise.
Right.
What would lead you to think that not only does God exist, but he's benevolent? And how benevolent?
Well, I think that you really shouldn't be able to put a limit on benevolence.
I think you should be able to put a lower limit on benevolence. If your idea of benevolence is to allow people to enslave others and to sit around and do nothing while people are molested and suffering, I don't know that you can consider yourself benevolent in any respect at all. But, you know, like...
Well, I'm reminded immediately of the problem of evil, right?
Yeah.
Where does evil come from if you've got a presumably all-powerful God that knows everything and is benevolent?
Yeah, this is why I'm asking how benevolent. It's not like I would agree there's no upper limit on benevolence.
Yes, and I like the question about the problem of evil. And I think that benevolence has to be something that is willing to be shared with everyone. Everyone has the opportunity of being benevolent or loving. And if I understand correctly, love cannot occur unless you have the freedom to do so. I mean, you should be able to free to love.
I don't think that that's true.
So what do you think would be necessary for love to occur?
A brain.
Right. So love is just the outworking of intellect only, or just emotions?
Well, if you're going to divide it between intellect and emotions, it's both of them. But, you know, I don't choose who I fall in love with. And so the notion of freedom has, I don't see any grounds for that at all. But... setting aside, see, this is one of the things that frustrates me, is that you call in to say that you believe in a benevolent God. And then we end up talking about love. I'm looking for what reason one would have to think that there is, in fact, a benevolent God.
Well, I believe that we can go down maybe the same track that Sir Isaac Newton used for believing in the Bible, and that would be prophecy.
Okay, so now we're not talking about a benevolent God at all, but now you want to talk about a biblical God?
Well, I believe the biblical God is a benevolent God. So
okay, well,
I don't.
Yeah. Not only do I not think he exists, I don't think the character as represented is fairly considered to be benevolent in any sense. And also what Isaac Newton has to say about it is irrelevant.
It might be a starting point for discussion, but it's not.
So the thing is, if I become convinced of something, I want it to be for good reasons, for arguments supported by evidence, not for appealing to, let me name a smart person who was monumentally wrong on many things, including alchemy, and we'll go down that route. I don't care what Isaac Newton says. I don't care what Albert Einstein says. What I care about is what is the argument and what is the evidence that supports the argument. Now, if you believe there's a benevolent God, you must have a reason. And if your reason is nothing other than you have special notions about love and you heard something from Isaac Newton, you're never going to make any headway here.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I believe that because of the prophecies found in both Daniel and Revelation and how they have been coming true, I believe supports the idea that God exists, who knows the future.
And I don't. And the problem with prophecy is that in order for prophecy to be impactful at all, it needs to be specific and answerable by a clear, not interpreted set of circumstances. So you can't go to Daniel or Revelation, both of which sound like the ravings of madmen, and say, this says this, and I'm going to interpret it this way, and look, it seems to have come to pass. Because there's a number of problems. If I order a medium rare steak and I get a medium rare steak, the waiter's not fulfilling prophecy. If there are people actively working to bring around a state of Israel, then any prophecies about a state of Israel have nothing to do with, you know, seeing the future. But at the end of the day, let's imagine that in Daniel, there was a clear prophecy. X will happen. And it was clearly answered by a specific circumstance, that there's no ambiguity, no interpretation. Now you have a prediction and a prediction that has actually come to pass. We don't have that, but if we had that, what conclusion could we reach about the person who wrote that prediction down?
Well, we could believe either they're pretty lucky or they're pretty good at predicting the future or they know the future. But if I may...
But there's a lot of other options as well. But how do you tell which of those is correct? Did they actually have foreknowledge? You see, you can't even get to a point where you could demonstrate that they had foreknowledge of the future. But I'll go a step further. Let's say that you've done all the work to show that the author of Daniel actually had foreknowledge of the future. He didn't get lucky, but he knew what was going to happen, and it came to pass. How did he know?
Well, I mean, that is a difficult question.
But you are convinced that you have answered it. You are convinced that not only is there a prediction that has come true, but evidently it should meet the standards by which, you know, we would consider it valid, and that the reason this guy knew what was going to happen in the future is because of God. Now, that is a chain of inferences, and there's a video I'm working on right now, which I've cleverly titled Compound Inference, that demonstrates the problem with putting one inference on top of another. I've gone ahead and I've granted way more than any reasonable person should in order to demonstrate that even if you had, like, I stand on stage and I make predictions about the future and read people's mind as part of my act. I am incredibly accurate. I can make amazing, detailed predictions about what an audience is going to do and show that I have done it. Now, the question then becomes, how did I do it? Was there a God that told me? Was there something else that told me? Did I have access to some knowledge base? Do I have a time machine? You can't narrow down. Was it trickery? You can't narrow down which one of those is the answer. But when we look at these things, the likelihood that I use trickery seems to be far more likely than many of the other explanations. And if you think that I'm actually getting message from a god, that's something you'd have to demonstrate, not just assume or infer.
Yes, point taken. And I think it would have to be up to each person to decide.
Well, that's garbage.
Of course,
every person gets to decide. Every person gets to decide for themselves. But the issue is, who's right? The fact that everybody gets to decide, I mean, there are people who decided that white people are better than black people. There are people who have decided that the earth is flat. Does that mean that they're remotely right? Does it mean that we should consider their opinions equal to those? Does it mean that we have no way of evaluating what is true?
Well, may I pass just one small prophecy by you and see
sure.
what you think?
Sure.
Well, in Daniel, and some people think that it's written at various different times, but let's just say that it was written, you know, around about the time of Christ. Let's not even put it before the time of Christ. And
you're saying the book of Daniel was written around the time of Christ?
I'm saying that I'm not demanding that everyone believe it was written before. So I don't think that you would believe that Daniel was written at about 500 or 600 BC.
I don't think I'd have too massive a problem with that rough time. It doesn't need to be dated anywhere near, you know, 300 or 30 CE. I mean, it's, you know, go ahead.
Right. Okay. So in the book of Daniel, we have a dream in Daniel chapter 2 where we have this statue. And by having a look at it, the statue, there's a head of gold. And the head of gold represents Babylon. And if we follow through the kingdoms that come after, we see that there's Babylon, followed by Medo-Persia, followed by Greece, followed by the Roman Empire. And if we allow that was written at about 500 or so BC, then that's a fairly accurate prediction of the kingdoms that would follow each other on planet Earth.
Bullshit. Let's read the actual passage, because you just listed a number of civilizations by name in the order in which they occurred. And you're talking about a passage in Daniel where he has a dream about a statue with a head. And you think that this is, I forget the exact phrasing you just used, but
prophetic.
In any case, you think this is the dream is an accurate representation of what happened. So chapter and verse. Give me chapter and verse. We'll pull it up together.
Yeah, so that would be Daniel chapter 2, just having a look here, and near the beginning of Daniel chapter 2.
Do you have a preferred Bible version? I'll just go with King James, because...
Yeah, that's fine. And so we have the dream that occurs earlier in the chapter, and then if we come down... to starting about verse 31 or so, Daniel interprets what the dream means.
Right. So it wasn't even Daniel's dream. So that part, you kind of skipped over. You implied that Daniel had a dream, but actually it was Nebuchadnezzar that had the dream, and he asked Daniel to interpret it.
Yes, that's correct. It's a dream in the book of Daniel by Nebuchadnezzar.
Yeah.
And,
So starting at verse 31, here, I'll just read this. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that they were iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces, and became like the chaffs of summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Now, that's the description of the dream.
Yes.
Yeah. So somebody dreamed about a statue of gold and brass and silver and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Now, the interpretation is... For the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, and the fowls, and the heaven, and the hath he given unto thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. So he's saying Nebuchadnezzar is this head of gold.
Yes.
Okay. And after
Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom.
Yeah. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another kingdom of brass, which shall rule over the earth. And it's basically he's saying what you saw is a prediction that after your kingdom, there'll be another kingdom and another kingdom and another kingdom. Right?
Yes.
Doesn't that happen all the time throughout history everywhere?
Yes, and
so how is that remotely remarkable?
Well, if we have a look down through these kingdoms, we see that we have the kingdom of Medo-Persia, then the kingdom of Greece, and then the kingdom after that will be Rome. And it's interesting how the legs were of iron, and Rome is kind of that iron kingdom that came forth from Nebuchadnezzar.
Okay, I find this to be absolutely indicative of people finding exactly what they're looking for. This is not any sort of prediction that I would consider to be specific or impressive. It's obviously prone to interpretation since we have Daniel interpreting the dream of a king to begin with. And none of these things are named. So you have this limited set of information, and now you're going to try to find a way to piece it together with what we know happened afterwards. That's not a prophecy fulfilled. That is someone looking at the world and going, wow, I can make this fit. And it's completely unsurprising when you consider that, as you and I both agreed, this is the sort of thing that happens. Now, here's the worst part of it. You're God. Let's say you're God. And
okay.
And you want to set up something to convince David in 2018 that you are real and benevolent. So what you do is you have a king have a really weird dream, and you send your guy down to interpret that dream in a way that is wholly unremarkable and will not be even subject to proof or confirmation for centuries. And that way, David, when he reads the Bible, can go through and say, ah, yeah, look, this kind of matches up. And yet you manage to get so many other things wrong, like the order of events in creation or whether or not we should own people as property. So this is an example where somebody's gone in and cherry picked something and said, you know what? This seems to predict what happened afterwards. And yet there's nothing remarkable in it. And there's no way to prove that it was a prediction made with foreknowledge. And if you could prove that it was a prediction made with foreknowledge, you couldn't prove how that person came by that foreknowledge. Is it that remarkable that somebody summoned before a king and asked to interpret their dream, that that person would have said something that seems to pertain to the dream that could possibly be viewed as coming true and yet is absolutely unverifiable at the time? The king rewards Daniel for this interpretation, even though he has no reason to believe that the interpretation is true. None. Because none of those things have happened in the course of this discussion. So somebody walks in and tells the king, hey, look, when your kingdom falls, there'll be another one after that, and another one after that, and another one after that. And I'm like, wow, that's the best interpretation of a dream I've ever heard. Congratulations, you are now a man of measure. And God is doing all of this so that you'll have a justification to think that there's a benevolent God?
Well, there's also another dream in Daniel chapter 7. Now, this one here gives very little detail, and
it
really isn't enough to believe anything.
Why would you go to a less compelling argument after the first one?
All right. Well, because the dream in Daniel chapter 7 is actually very, very specific. If we take Daniel chapter 7 and 8, they're incredibly specific.
Does it have dates?
Yes, it has a time period that is met precisely to the year.
Well, what humor are you, it looks like.
Okay.
Okay. Well, in Daniel chapter 7, we have this idea of kingdoms, one coming after another, also repeated, except this time, instead of being represented as metals in a statue, it's represented by different beasts. And so there's a lion with wings, there's a bear, there's a cheetah, and then there's a terrifying beast. And those four beasts line
the others
up
weren't.
Four metals. Well, they do sound a bit that way. That line up with the four metals in the statue. And once again, we come through Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now, this kind of understanding is if you go to the city of Nuremberg, there's a public building there, and there's two entrances to the public building. If you look at the two entrances above the public building, you'll actually see the rulers of these four kingdoms and those four beasts there. So this is a very, very common understanding that people have shared for many, many centuries.
Does that have any bearing on whether or not it's true?
No, but...
No, then there's no reason to raise it, right? Because if there's something that has no bearing on whether or not something's true, raising it in a discussion about truth is essentially poisoning the well. It's an attempt to wring in credibility that's not deserved.
I wasn't meaning to do that. I was just trying to show that this is not just my personal understanding. That's all.
Sure, I understand that.
I wasn't trying to get authority on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. I don't want to get any authority from that, though. So when you get to the fourth beast, you would think, oh, kingdom, 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 maybe another kingdom. But instead, the fourth beast has 10 horns on it, which says, are the next. So that fourth beast is then supplanted by 10 kings or 10 kingdoms. And incredibly, when Rome falls in about 476 CE, we have that Rome wasn't supplanted by another kingdom as such, but it was divided more or less into 10 kingdoms. And that's a fairly specific...
No, it's not.
Change.
No, it's not. You're following this path, and then what if when Rome had split, then instead of being 10, which I'm not necessarily convinced is accurate anyway, it just been 2, and then the one after that had split into 10.
Yes, we'll see that wouldn't fit the prophecy.
Oh, I bet you people would just say that one of them didn't count. The fact of the matter is, you need a prophecy that predicts something so specific that it can only be answered by a single occurrence with no interpretation. And a god would know this. Any god that is using this method, any god that is giving people dreams about beasts and statues and then having someone interpret them and then letting people a millennia later go back and see if they can massage things to fit.
Spin doctorate.
Is a jackass and not very bright. Because if the purpose is to show that you exist and to guide people to an understanding that you're a benevolent god who's here, why not just talk to people?
Well, he has talked to people in past, if my
Prove
understanding
it.
Is correct.
Prove it.
Well, this is what this prophecy is about.
He hasn't talked to me.
Go further.
He hasn't talked to me, and until he does, he's not worth 5 minutes of my time.
If we can go through a few more specifics, it also says that three of those kingdoms would be uprooted by another kingdom that is not just only a civil power, that's also religious. And if we go back to around about 476 AD after Rome divided up, we see that a religious power came to the fore, which was the pontifical power, because in one way, the Roman civil power got superseded by the Rome religious power.
Did the universe end with Rome, or was there anything after that?
No, Rome got divided up into about 10 kingdoms.
About 10? I thought it was exactly 10.
Well, 10 kingdoms. And then three of them got uprooted by a religious power. So if we have a look at that historically, in 538.
We are completely wasting time because you've already acknowledged that you have no way to demonstrate that there was actually foreknowledge and that it actually came from God, correct?
An understanding of this prophecy does...
It's not prophecy just because you call it prophecy. I started at the very beginning of the call pointing this out. I granted everything I could possibly grant to show that even if there was a specific prophecy that actually turned out to be true, you still don't have any sort of evidence or mechanism to show how and why that person wrote that. Did they know about the future, and how did they know about the future? You have no way of showing that. It's just what you believe.
Well, I do believe that if people can tell the future accurately in sort of like for hundreds of centuries, that does show something.
Actually,
I don't see any accuracy there.
Not only do I see any accuracy, but the longer the time is between the interpretation or between the prophecy and the event, the more likelihood it is to come true. Hey, here's a prophecy for you. The United States will elect a woman as president.
You would have to say the next president of the United States would be a woman.
Funny how you want
high
specifics
standards
now.
For Matt's prophecy, but you got low standards for yours.
So with the prophecy, we have specifically four kingdoms and then next.
So did they name the kingdoms? Did they name the dates? Animals are not kingdoms. Materials and statues are not kingdoms.
Well, in Daniel, it says that the animal, the beast, is a kingdom. That's what it actually says.
Care.
Is a kingdom.
I pointed out earlier, Daniel reads like the ravings of a madman, as does Revelation. And this sets all of these things in the context of interpretation. There's no way for you to demonstrate this. And it is, by definition, unreasonable for you to reach the conclusion that the best explanation for this convergence of a supposed prediction and event is that God knows the future and exists. When we want to say, how did this happen? How did this person write something that we think came true? We list candidate explanations. He had trickery. He was the doctor. He had a time machine. He guessed and got lucky. He made predictions that weren't particularly specific. And centuries later, people went back and looked and said, if you interpret it this way, then it came true. Those are all candidate explanations because we know all of those things can happen. The candidate explanation that you've chosen is one that we don't know can happen. You have by definition leaped to the one explanation for which we do not have any examples of it ever being a correct explanation.
Well, that would be under the assumption that there is no supernatural.
No, sir. No, sir. No, sir. No, sir. No, 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 sir. It's not under any assumption. It's not under an assumption. You are suggesting that the best explanation is one that has never shown to be correct. I don't have to deny the supernatural or anything else. There is no point in history in which God did it has been demonstrated to be the correct explanation.
Well, that's where you and I would disagree.
That's where you're wrong.
And that's fair enough.
It's fair enough. We disagree.
We disagree. Before we go on,
isn't
there some sort of Bible prophecy about the kingdom of Abraham and his line going forever?
No, his descendants will become as numerous as the stars.
Oh,
not forever.
Not forever. Okay.
There are way more stars.
There's still way more stars.
But we're not done yet.
Yeah, I think he hung up on somebody that didn't call back.
Yeah, that was actually it's an accident. But my call screener app evidently is not refreshing. So we'll try that again.
Yeah, the prophecy stuff gets tiresome pretty quick.
Well, it's here's the thing, and this is what I tried to demonstrate. If you were God, this is one of the chapters in the book deals with prophecy, the If I Were God book. What is my goal? Hey, I want to give people information so that they can have a reasonable foundation to believe in me. And my method for doing this is to give somebody a dream and then ask somebody else to interpret that dream in such a way that if we kind of squint one eye and lean a little to the left, we can look back 700 years later and see that, that kind of lines up. That's actually pretty good. And there is no reasonable way at the end of that trail of thought to reach the conclusion that, you know what, the best explanation is that God did this.
Well, and there's nothing remarkable in this dream, right? If he came down and explained quantum mechanics to us in a way that worked out, that'd be pretty impressive, right?
Yeah.
We still wouldn't be sure it was a god, but it'd be a hell of a lot more impressive than this stuff.
it's frustrating because this is not about IQ. This is not about intelligence or smarts or anything else. This is about having a sound epistemology. This is about the tools of skepticism and critical thinking. Because it's very easy, incredibly easy, especially if you're raised in a church, to say, look, here's what it says in Daniel, and here's something that matches it.
Yeah.
Holy cow, only God could have known. And as long as you're already in the mindset that God is a reasonable explanation for things, then that is the way it is. It's like, it's when I debated Mike Lacona on the resurrection, he spent all his time trying to argue from floating trash can lids and Ouija boards that the universe has a spiritual aspect to it. And he did all of that so that he could kind of smuggle in the resurrection because then it would seem more reasonable. The thing is, the debate wasn't about how the resurrection happened. It was about whether or not the resurrection happened. And if the debate is about whether the resurrection happened, then all of this hand-waving about supernatural and Ouija boards, and that's all irrelevant. Because the only thing you have to show me to convince me that a resurrection occurred is, here's a person, well-documented that this person's dead. Preferably, I would like to check it out, you know, some, or at least reasonable doctors, etc. Some period of time beyond which people don't recover. And then the person gets up and walks in. He even went to this thing of having the person's head cut off, and if they walked in the room afterwards, with their head back on, would I then believe in the supernatural? And I said, no, but I would believe that somebody who I thought to be dead was now alive. How it happened is a separate issue.
Separate thing, right.
It's weird that, you know, at the end of this, it's just like, well, I have seen no evidence anywhere that God did it, has been demonstrated to be the correct explanation.
Right.
Well, and the caller thinks
often used explanation, but not a correct one.
Yeah. And yet the caller seems to think that, it has been shown.
Right.
So
because
from now on,
he can point at a mystery and say, God did it.
Instead of calling to tell me that you believe in a benevolent God, which we never really did get to.
We went down the rabbit hole pretty quick.
If the issue is, why do you believe that a God exists? And you're just like, it's prophecy and God has been the correct explanation. No, it hasn't. That's the part where we need to start.
Dan Barker has a pretty good book on the, the God of the Bible and his character. And
yeah.
So, read that one.
it's funny for me because even when I was a believer, looking at Daniel and Revelation and seeing these things that people were holding up as prophecies, it's a lot of cherry picking. It is a lot of interpretation. And then you have, like, the author of the book of Matthew was so fond of prophecy that he even invented some out of whole cloth for Jesus to fulfill. And it's one of those things of, we have no mechanism to demonstrate how a prediction came true. God should know that.
Right.
So why is God running around, I will prove it to you with prophecies? It's like saying, I will prove it to you through your feels. Your feels are proof of nothing other than that you have feels, but I'll just make you feel it, and that'll be proof. That's not a smart God. That's not a God that understands how things should be proven.
Yeah.
It's certainly not a God that designed the human brain.
It's like this all-powerful God coming down and pulling a quarter from behind your ear.
All right. Enough really bad magic. We have, is it Juan in Topeka?
Yes, sir. It's Juwan. How are you doing?
I'm good, Juwan. How are you?
I'm doing well, Matt. Thank you for asking. Matt and Don, thank you guys for taking my phone call. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. What do you got for us?
I'd like to know if it's possible to have a dialogue with you about getting some perspective on the God of the Old Testament's behavior, maybe practicing some discernment and questions that we've all asked about some of the things that it's written that God does. Maybe we can get some perspective on it.
So
that'd be okay.
Well, the thing is, let's say that we have this and you and I come to an agreement that the character of the God of the Old Testament is not nearly as bad as I think he is. Like, I'm assuming that would be your goal, unless you think that God is an immoral thug.
Well, I hope you're not saying that I'm hoping to have this discussion with you to then turn around and say, "Batcher, the God of the Bible is real." It's not meant to do anything.
No. No, I'm just saying, okay, here, let me solve this the easy way. I think the God of the Old Testament is a fictional, infantile, immoral thug. I'm assuming you disagree.
Well, even if I do disagree or not, we can possibly look at the Bible, and with your opinion on God, maybe we can apply that then to the Bible, and I can understand your opinion. Maybe I can have an opinion that you can understand, and I can get some insight into why you believe what you believe about the God of the Bible.
Well,
this is a little like, you know, arguing about Star Trek characters.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go. Is there any reason we wouldn't have a discussion about whether or not Thanos was right to snap his fingers and wipe out half of the universe?
I'm sorry, I have no idea who you're talking about.
Ah, Avengers, Infinity War. He gets hold of the Infinity Gauntlet, and his goal is to wipe out half of this, and he has what he thinks are noble reasons, but yet he's the villain of that. So we can have a big conversation about whether or not he's doing the right thing or not, how immoral he is. Maybe if we don't want to go down that route, we could talk about Lord Voldemort and whether or not his views about pure blood and mud blood were valuable. I don't think we do that on the show because there are plenty of gods proposed that I would argue are not the immoral thug that we see in the Old Testament. And I don't think they exist either. And I don't see any reason to spend time talking about their character unless there's a demonstration that they exist.
Gotcha. It wouldn't be to maybe demonstrate that they're not the immoral thug.
Well, you know,
the call dropped. We didn't touch anything. The call dropped.
It's a literary discussion more than anything else.
This is why I was saying, at the end of the day, if you manage to convince me that the God of the Bible had good, sound, moral, even benevolent reasons for all of the things he ordered and all of the things he did, then the only thing you've achieved is to convince me that a fictional character had good reasons for this.
In his fictional universe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know he dropped the call, and I'm hoping that's him calling back in, but it's hard to tell.
It'd be nice to be able to finish it up.
I don't think it is.
Yeah, we'll have to
move on. We'll go with John in Panama City, Florida. You're on with Matt and Don.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad.
What's up?
So, first I want to shout out to my friend Wes. He told me to call into the show. I don't know if he's listening right now.
Okay.
Hey, Wes.
Yeah, he's promoting your stuff, yeah. Okay. So, I had, like, just watching your show, I had, like, 1,000 things I wanted to bring up. But the main thing I wanted to bring up was you were just discussing the Bible.
Yeah.
And I want to know, how much of the Bible do you think could possibly be true? Like, how much do you think could align with the secular records of history?
You're talking about a historical aspect or the philosophical or the moral?
Could Jesus have existed? Paul, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are these people who could have existed?
Oh, well, on the question of Jesus's historicity, I don't have any problem with the notion that there may have been a person at the center of that. I'm not a mythicist. When it comes to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the notion that somebody may have existed like that is not a problem. What we do know, though, is that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't write the Gospels that their names are attributed to. Those are anonymous texts, and those are traditional authorship. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John become irrelevant. Whoever the author of those books were, was relaying a story, and there are elements of any of those stories that are clearly true. I mean, you know, you talk about real places and everything else. There are elements of the story that I have no problem with the idea that they could possibly be true, even if there's no way to demonstrate it. And there are other things that I see no good reason to think they could ever be true, like miracles.
Well, for example, Paul is, now granted, this is not something I could point you to a book on right now. Just side note in my mind, before I get to the next thing I wanted to discuss, Paul is mentioned in secular texts. So is Jesus. And I would
Jesus
have to do my homework and then call back in.
Yeah, you probably should because Jesus isn't mentioned in any contemporary secular texts. Nothing written during the time that he...
written from 2,000 years ago, contemporary?
Sorry?
Well, is anything written 2,000 years ago considered contemporary?
Yes, contemporary with him. If he was alive from 0 to 33, then that would be the period where contemporary authors would be writing, not 200, 300, 400 years later. So, like, right. If I wrote a book about Elvis, that's not contemporary because Elvis is dead.
But did you overlap with Elvis? Were you able to see Elvis?
Now,
that's some of the
questions. My account of Elvis is probably going to be more accurate and more reasonable because I have access to sources who knew Elvis than somebody 100 years from now will be. But neither of them are actually contemporary. And the further we are removed from the events, the less credence we put. And Jesus, no specific event from Jesus' life is recorded by any contemporary. And even Paul's writings aren't contemporary. And the Gospels aren't contemporary. They were written afterwards. That doesn't mean that there weren't people there who knew these stories or were familiar with these stories. But we're not talking about eyewitnesses' accounts. And we're not talking about things that can be verified.
True. All right.
I don't have an issue.
I'll have to do a little bit of homework. Like the next thing I wanted to. Now this was more of a fun thing I had in mind. Are you familiar with the concept of steel manning?
Yes.
Could you steel man theism for me and then deconstruct it from there?
Maybe you should tell the audience what that is.
Steel manning is taking the opponent's position and constructing the best actual case for it, rather than straw manning, which is to construct something flimsy you can knock down.
You want us to turn our intellect towards Satan.
Yeah. Having done this many times and having been on the opposite side for, you know, more than 20 some odd years, the problem is that I don't know of any way to, well, if I were to steel man theism.
Not necessarily Christianity, but the belief that there is a God.
I can't do it without recognizing the fallacies in the actual argument, because I have yet to be presented.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like present the steel man version of the argument for theism and then knock it down.
Well,
like,
that,
what is the most,
that's what I've done for 15. That's what it.
Yeah,
sure. At the end of the day, the best arguments for a God tend to boil down to essentially arguments from ignorance, that we have no other explanation, therefore God is the best explanation. Those are the ones that are most convincing and compelling people, along with their personal experience of, hey, I was in church and we were all singing and I felt euphoric and therefore that's the Holy Spirit. There's no actual connection, no way to demonstrate a connection. It is just, this is what I became convinced of. Now, the problem is, for theism, and for most stripes of theism and for even the arguments that I just presented, there's no way to show that the position is false. These are essentially unfalsifiable positions. And I don't know that there's any real way to steel man them.
All right.
Or at least the attempt to steel man them still results in obviously flawed arguments.
Do you think it's only possible to straw man it?
No, I'm not. I'm
like even if you're trying to craft metal.
We want to have an honest discussion and get
I'm
the
not
truth.
Straw manning. People are saying they believe in a God and they have reasons, and I'm addressing those reasons and showing where there are flaws. That's not straw manning. Straw manning would be if I said Christians are stupid and think there's a bearded man up in the sky who's going to help them win football games. That would be a straw man, because that is not foundational to almost any view of Christianity or God, and it would be it would be a caricature that I put up there specifically to get rid of, and that's not what I'm doing. I'm addressing what people say they believe and why they say they believe it, and pointing out where I do agree and where I don't.
All right. All right. Well, that's all I got for you right now. I don't want to take up any more time on the show, but thanks for the discussion.
I'd like for you to call back and hit us with some
absolutely.
Of the other stuff.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. Take it easy.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where, you know, hey, your friend had you call in, and I know what his friend was expecting. but if you aren't calling in to tell us what you believe and why.
These meta conversations are not so interesting. And
Well, it could have been. It could have been just a genuine. Let me see who these guys on the show are and what, because you know we could have been the kind of jackasses that were, oh, there's a bearded man in the sky who's going to help you win football games type thing, or it could, you know, we could kind of know what we're talking about. But people call in about all different. It's not just Christians calling in, although it's predominantly Christians.
Yeah.
And it's weird for me because I'm sitting here as somebody who was a believer for years. And as somebody who cares about the truth. And so what I want is, here's a good reason to believe something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you ask me to steelman a position, with a little bit of study, I could probably, certainly I could play the role of the other side. I could come up, I can do, you know, the Kalam cosmological argument word for word verbatim from memory. And if someone is convinced that that is the best argument for the existence of God, then I have just steelmanned it. However, I've also presented the rebuttals to that as well. And at the end of the day, if you're calling in for me to do both sides of the argument, I love me and I talk a lot, but you don't get to saddle me with both sides of the debate.
Well, I'll tell you what threw me a little bit is one of the things that's really impressed on me is just the complete variety of beliefs. You know, there is no such thing as a Christian because everybody's got their own spin and their own interpretations and all that. And it's not like there is one thing out there to argue for. It's the scattering of stuff. And, I don't know.
I don't either. let me see if I can take care of this one pretty quick. We got Theo in Arizona. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Mr. Dylan Hunting. How are you doing, Mr. Baker?
Good.
Well, I recently came through a few discussions. I actually watched a video from Matt Delhunty several years ago in regards to the default position, in regards to the analogy of the gumball analogy. And I also saw an updated video you did, Matt, about...
Last month.
About 2000... What's that, sir?
I did one last month or so.
Yeah, and I noticed how you... Well, there's also one you did in 2013 in relation to an updated discussion on how you were using a different analogy of guilty until proven innocent and that default position. But I've been seeing...
There's an update to that one that I just released on my Patreon last month, which moves things out to the point of view of the district attorney because it makes it a little easier to see whether or not... The issue is whether or not we have sufficient evidence to bring charges to put before a jury.
Gotcha, sir. Well, there has been a number of theistic individuals I would quantify on YouTube, for example, that have made a different analogy in regards to the unwritten rule of baseball of the tie goes to the runner. And one of the main arguments I've been hearing some of these theists make is that if you have a default position, it's a form of cowardice because you choose not to pick one side or the other. And one of the issues...
Okay, then I'm a coward. Then I'm a coward, but I'm not going to fucking be wrong.
Absolutely. Well, the only reason why I wanted to ask your opinion on this, Mr. Delahunty, and you, of course, Mr. Baker, is I came up with there's two analogies I came up with myself that kind of debunks, or that's a wrong word, or really is critical in regards to that analogy. And the first one that comes to my mind is we have police officers that are trained all the time in regards to how to react in regards to a dangerous situation in reference to using their weapons as a last resort in regards to that. And that's a default position. And it
sure
also,
doesn't seem that way lately.
I would agree with you, Mr. Delahunty, but you know, that's typically, that's the expectation we would have among.
Sure. So what's the analogy?
Well, the analysis is the analogy that a gentleman put out. He goes, suppose there's an umpire on a baseball game. It's the bottom of the ninth and it's the World Series. There are two outs and the score is tied. A ground ball is hit and the runner dashes to home plate. The shortstop initially fumbles the ball, but the third baseman picks it up and throws it to home. The catcher catches the ball while the runner slides into home plate. Now, there are some that are... Now, there is one thing sure that either the runner is either safe or out. The runner says that that he is safe, but he offers no proof. The catcher says that the runner is out and still offers no proof. The umpire, who is considered the atheist in this analogy,
well, that's
he simply announces that he doesn't. Go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
No, he simply announces he has no determination. And basically,
That's not the case. That's not remotely the case. I don't even have to know sports ball to know that this is not remotely the case.
Absolutely.
There is a rule that the tie goes to the runner. If the umpire is unable to make a call, basically you are safe until determined out. In the same way that you are innocent until proven guilty. But the fact that, like, let's say I'm not watching it and nobody's looking. I'm the umpire and I didn't see the play. Then the rules are such that I need to err on the side of innocence or safety. That does not mean that I'm convinced that the runner was actually safe. It means I'm acknowledging that the default position is that a tie goes to the runner. Maybe I blinked. Maybe I'm not sure. Maybe it was, but in that case, as the umpire, because I'm in a game, I am forced to make a ruling. When it comes to the issue of whether or not there's a God, I am never forced to make up my mind. I have, in fact, tentatively made up my mind. Not only am I not convinced that there's a God, I'm convinced that there isn't a God for most normative definitions and anything that'd be useful. And I think that this little playing around with, oh, we put the atheist in the position of the umpire, the analogy fails because I don't ever have to make a decision on God. And if I do, I can change my mind. Once the game's over, the umpire has no recourse to go and change his mind and say, you know what? I think in hindsight, that guy was actually out. The game's over. I don't have to make up my mind.
It's colorful and dramatic, though.
Yeah. Well, see, one of the things that came to my mind in regards to my own analogy, other than the police officer, is if they're making that discussion and talking point in relation to a default position, couldn't that same supposition be applied to God as well? Because I maybe I'm wrong here, but if you look at God, supposedly he has this grand plan for everyone. He has a default position, which is his grand plan. So if his determination is having a default position as a form of cowardice, wouldn't that also be regarded toward God as well?
No. So this whole thing about, I don't know why this is so hard to explain, the default position. The default position is not a default between two positions. It is a default position with respect to one position. The one proposition, some God exists, the default position is to not accept that until such time as there's sufficient evidence. And here's another proposition, no God exists. The default position is to not accept that until such time as the evidence warrants it. Going to the baseball, the runner is out. The default position is to not accept that until such time as the runner has been shown to be out. Oh, the runner is safe. Well, in baseball, the rules specifically say that the runner is safe until proven. It's a judgment call, and it is based on evidence. And so people are claiming that God is guilty of existing, and I'm sitting on a jury, and I can find God not guilty of existing without actually believing that God doesn't exist. In the same way that I can find somebody not guilty of murder and not think that they're completely innocent of this. The problem with all of these is that people try to view two mutually exclusive positions and say one of these two has to be the default position, and they're wrong. The default position is to reject both of those until such time as they're warranted, or you can still do the rules of baseball have the tie goes to the runner thing, or I actually have to make a decision. You know, like Don's going to flip a coin and he wants me to call it heads or tails. And I could sit here and say, well, I don't know which one is going to be. I don't know which. Can I watch it first? Because that's what a skeptic would do. But at some point, the nature of this game is that I have to make a decision before that coin hits the table and lands. And even in that scenario, I can just refuse to play.
If I may ask Mr. Dillon to get your opinion on this, I could be wrong here, but if someone had that position, wouldn't that also
had be what position?
Black and white, have the position that there's only two choices?
They're wrong.
Wouldn't that be?
They are absolutely demonstrably, moronically fucking wrong. It's really easy to demonstrate that I don't have to be convinced of either position. I do not have to be convinced that a God exists. I do not have to be convinced that no God exists. I can be in a position where I am not convinced of either of those.
Well, the only thing I was going to mention, Mr. Delaney, wouldn't that be considered a black and white fallacy in regards to the reasoning? I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that. Or a false dichotomy, like they view it as only one of two choices. I mean, isn't that considered a logical fallacy as well?
Well, yeah, sure. That if they say there's only two positions when there's three, they're wrong.
Absolutely. I greatly appreciate your feedback on this, Mr. Delahunty. That's
sure.
The only question I had. So I do want to mention, in reference to your original, the very first call you had from that gentleman from Australia, I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness in a Millerite cult for 22 years.
Yeah.
And I wish I could have a conversation with that individual in regards to the multiple false predictions I've experienced firsthand in relation to that religious sect. So,
well, we do have a blog, and there will be a posting for this show not too long after, and maybe the two of you can both meet up there and hash it out.
Definitely, sir. Well, okay. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Mr. Delahunty, Mr. Baker, and thank you so much for your feedback, sir.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You guys have a great evening.
I feel old.
I feel old. Yeah, yeah, I was just going to say.
Mr. Baker, when you showed up here today, I wasn't sure that you would actually be able to do today's show.
Right.
Are you wearing your Depends?
A little slow. Yeah. Need to get some suspenders or something.
And we have Jane in Columbus. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, how are you guys tonight?
Just fine. How are you?
I don't even know how to answer that.
It's nice to have a female voice for once on this show.
What was that?
Hope you guys are having a blessed day out there so far.
So far.
Not as far as I can tell.
What you got for us?
Okay, well, first of all, the screening questions were very interesting, so thank you for that.
I have no idea what questions people are asked when they're screened.
Okay.
But...
So, I just want to state I am a pantheist, which means I just, as you would say, a default, that I just generally believe that a higher power exists.
Have you got any reason for that, or is that just like
a feeling?
That's just me personally.
Well, I know it's you personally. I was just wondering if there was a reason or if you just kind of felt that way.
I've always been spiritual for, you know, my whole life. I didn't grow up in a religious household. I wasn't indoctrinated. I kind of came into it by my own merit, and I have multiple belief systems. So I don't hold a position in, okay, well, Jesus was the founder or this person was the founder. I just believe that there have been many messengers and teachers. But one thing I've been having a problem with is it seems like modern Christianity, and no offense, because I see the Bible as more of an inspirational thing. Aside from the hateful texts in there, like about slavery.
If we dump all the garbage and just keep some, you know, nice things about
a few turds,
hey, turn the other cheek. That's really inspirational.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the morality and all that.
The morality is abhorrent. The morality of the Bible is vile and disgusting and repugnant.
You know, I respect your viewpoints. You know, I like listening to these things. I like Richard Carey debates. I like Christopher Hitchens. I can respect all their debates. And I love hearing these things, even though I have my own position and personal opinions on these things.
Well, I think if you respected somebody's position, you'd share it. I think what you mean is that you respect my right to have a view that differs from yours.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I respect that right, too. But I don't respect the positions of the people who are disagreeing. But go ahead.
But my thing is people, you know, devout, especially the evangelical culture, they are so convinced that Jesus is God. But when you read through the Bible, it only states in maybe one or two places that he may imply that.
How many do you need?
Nowhere, nowhere else does he imply it.
I and the Father are one. What more do you need? The guy was killed for putting himself co-equal with God, according to the book.
But my thing is that's more of a parable. That could be like...
It's not a parable.
I and my Father are one.
Well, the divinity of Jesus is a relatively late thing, right?
If you to look on me is to look on the Father. If you see me, you've seen the Father. You know, whatever. The thing is, you're faulting someone for sincerely accepting what their holy book says. And yet I would argue that your reasons for what you believe are less sturdy, sturdy than the people you're objecting to.
You know, why is it, you know, they can't just see him, you know, because the Bible was written after the time of Jesus.
Yeah.
And why, you know.
The Bible's kind of a Rorschach test. People bring to it what they want.
But there's more to it than that. There is a history of orthodoxy and doctrine. And if you are raised in that and you think you have a biblical foundation, here's the thing. And I don't mean this to be insulting to you, Jane. My thing is, I can stand up to Bible-believing Christians and point out that they have no good evidential foundation to believe what they believe. But the same thing applies to you, except that you have even less, because you don't have any sort of revelation. You don't have the ability to land back on claims of prophecy. You just have this warm fuzzy, and you kind of, let me take bits and pieces of everything. You've constructed a religion of your own making based on how you feel. And you're never going to make headway against them that way, because...
And it's not like I haven't read scientific journals that doesn't mean I don't understand about cosmology or anything like that. You know, I just by default believe in a higher power.
Well, I don't think it's by default. I think that belief is something that you have to become convinced of, and you can become convinced for good or bad reasons. And the reasons you've given so far are bad. Now, the problem here is that if you believe something for bad reasons and somebody else believes something for bad reasons and you're the one that's criticizing them, why can't they just look at Jesus the way I do? And they're going to say the same thing. Why can't Jane look at Jesus the same way we do? She just doesn't know. She hasn't read. She hasn't, you know, blah, blah, blah. Neither one of you.
I read my Bible every day. I read it daily.
Okay.
I read Psalms and Proverbs a lot, and but if Christianity, and I guess this is what I was trying to get at, not why I believe what I believe, but why is it if Christianity is supposed to be the religion of love, people are starting to see it as a hate thing? Like,
because it's not the religion of love. It never was, never will be. That's not what Christianity is. Even as a Southern Baptist, it's about God's love for human beings. It's not about you being loving. Christians are commanded to
represent. Right. So if they're commanded,
wait. You just said yeah, right. What is it that they're commanded? Because I hadn't finished. So what is it you think they're commanded to do?
Okay. So if they're supposed to accept Jesus. And there's, you know, I believe Jesus may have existed, you know, even though there's a stopping point when it comes to historical evidence for him outside of written sources.
You are now 10 miles away from the question I asked. What I'm trying to explain is that you have a particular view of the Bible, and Christians have a particular view of the Bible.
Yeah.
Now, the issue here is, how do we tell who's right? Well, if your foundation is based on what you feel and what you think, then you have no foundation. If they have a foundation that's based on what's written, it could be wrong, but at least it's stronger and sturdier, and it's external to them.
Okay.
It's not just their opinion.
Or at least some sort of historical dogma.
But if the reality is that I can sit here as the third party and point out that both you and Christians have beliefs that you don't have good reasons to hold, then I'm in the better position. It would be silly for me to go debate someone who talks about faith in Christ and have them say that, well, you wear your lucky socks and your lucky shirt and you go buy lottery tickets every week. I don't do that. But if that were the case, they would be correct to point out hypocrisy, because what I'm challenging is not the beliefs. I'm challenging the justification for the beliefs.
Yes. Okay. I can't
do that as a pantheist. I don't see any reason for pantheism or panentheism or theism of any stripe.
Well, you're an atheist, and I respect your stance on things, and I respect everybody else. But it just seems like, why are they becoming more hateful? It seems like they're really trying to, especially with everything going on in the world, it seems like they're really trying to be. And if God says, "Oh, well, come to me and accept my spirit," which I think is what God is, he isn't, to me, Jesus was just.
This no longer sounds like pantheism, but okay.
He was just a messenger. Well, it was just.
I think
a
some of the.
How do you know that?
The recent drama we've had with religious folks has largely been fear-based. They are losing power. They are losing numbers, and they're afraid of that.
The world is getting better.
The world is getting better, and they're
and the things
Ashford's beliefs are getting squeezed out.
Yeah, they are now waking up in a world where homosexuals can get married to each other,
and that's scary.
They are waking up in a world where. Their religious leaders are telling them that they are the victims, that their religious liberties and freedoms are being infringed on, when in reality, they're the ones that are doing the infringing. And when we stop them from doing it, when we take away the stick that they're beating people with, they want to whine and cry.
About their persecution.
They don't understand what they believe or why any better than you do.
And, from what I get from the Bible, what's taught, from the not the Old Testament, but the New Testament, is that they are to be Christ-like. Well, love
sure,
is an action word.
Yeah.
So if you're going to
you cherry-pick verses, but let's say I was going to be Christ-like. Christ was a jackass, too. Jesus, let me go make my own scourge and rip through the temple and run out the money launderers. Let me say terrible things, about the... I've come only to the house of Israel and blah, 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 and saying bad things about family. And I've done a whole verse-by-verse deconstruction of the Sermon on the Mount. And it's a mix. It's exactly what you'd expect. There's some good advice. There's some bad advice. And there's a whole lot of stuff in there to make people feel like they're victims. When the world turns against you, it's because you are righteous. Well, maybe it's because you're a dick. Maybe. And so people are using this and saying, oh, look, so many troubles. People are turned against me. It's Satan. Satan's coming after me because I'm so righteous and right with God. There was this guy. He's had 5 terms, I think, in the Washington State representative. I think he's a representative.
I think I might have heard about that.
He's now being watched, I guess, a little by the FBI because he wrote a book or a pamphlet or whatever on biblical war and how you need to kill the unbelievers and how you need to kill the boys. And basically, he was just going down. He wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong if what he wanted to write was what the Bible said he should do. He can cherry pick that shit just as easy as anybody else. And at the end of the day, if we're going to fix it, the thing that we have to do is get people to realize that they believe things for bad reasons. And that applies to you and pantheism as much as it does to Christianity. I don't think you're probably as dangerous.
And I think, I'm going to side with you in some aspects. I think that, if the church is to survive, then they, the church itself is going to survive. They need to embrace, the changes around.
No.
What's going on?
No,
not so sure.
Because if it's against their religious views, to embrace it would be to become a heretic. Would be to be an apostate. If you think that God is opposed to abortion, and you're just like, I'm not going to have one, but I'm fine living in a society that allows people to have one. You are no longer practicing the religion you believe. This is the thing that scares them. And it's not the only way for a religion to survive. You know how religions have tended to survive? By doing the thing that Islamic extremists are doing. By taking over governments. By imposing religious doctrine. By doing it, in some cases, by absolute force, but now we're a little more civilized, so we're just going to legislate your civil rights away because, for whatever reason, despite the fact that Matt feels like he wakes up in bizarro world every day, they have the majority. People who think that the earth is 6 to 10,000 years old or perhaps flat, or people who believe in sacrificing animals on burnt altars, even though we don't have to do it anymore. But once upon a time, it was a good idea because God likes it. And people who think that you're born bad and that you inherit sin from other people, and that what we can do is have Jesus give up a mildly bad weekend and fix everything for everybody. The people who think like this are a problem. But they're not the enemy. The ideas are the enemy. And going after those ideas, and this applies, sorry to say, Jane, to pantheism, panentheism, all stripes of theism, everything that cannot be demonstrated to be real, that people are believing are real and acting on behalf of and legislating on behalf of, those things need to be expunged from society.
And I can respect your opinions. I don't get offended easy. Trust me, I don't.
Okay.
You know, I have friends that are atheists, and it don't bother me. You know, they're still my friends, and, you know, I get in heated debates once in a while. But
okay, I want you to think about this, because we're out of time, and Parenting Beyond Belief is getting ready to start, so I'm going to wrap this up. Take the sentence you just said and start substituting other things in for atheists. I have friends that are black and it doesn't bother me. I have friends that are gay and it doesn't bother me. Think about how that sounds, because there's a hidden implication in there that there's something wrong with it, but you're personally going to be okay with it. And that's garbage. I'm not okay with it. Not remotely okay with it. I'm fine. I have friends that are gay and black and atheist and Christian, blah, 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 and they're still my friends and everything else. But I wouldn't ever do this sort of, well, I respect your opinion. I mean, it's kind of like the bless your heart crap that we hear in the South. Oh, bless your heart, which really means, God, you're an idiot, but I love you anyway.
No, I don't believe that about people. I really do.
One of the things we'd like to nudge you to do is to think about whether your beliefs are true and whether you have good reason to believe them.
And whether you care whether your beliefs are true, because evidently some people don't. And if you don't care, okay, fine. I think everybody can and does care when you finally get down to it. But if you care about whether or not your beliefs,
you know, I'm not one of them where I'll just say, hey, I don't agree with you, but I still care about you. I'll say that. I don't have to, you know, I'll say, hey, I don't exactly agree with what you say, you know, or, you know, but I still, and I'll say, hey, you know what? I'm not an atheist, but I respect your stance. I have a boss that's an atheist, and I told him that. And okay. He told me why he's an atheist. So I can...
Well, I don't say, respect your stance. I don't respect your position. Not one
bit. But
you're
a nice person.
But I respect the person, and I respect your right to hold that position. But I don't remotely respect your position. It may be a subtle little difference in language, but yes, it's true. I can respect and care about a person without agreeing with them, and I can absolutely despise their position. I have family members who have positions that I don't know if I could despise those positions more. And I will never tell them, I respect your position. What I will say is, I respect your right to hold a different view from mine, but your position is repugnant. Not you. Well, yours is unjustified as far as I can tell, but not nearly as repugnant as like the guy who's creating the Bible manual for killing people. But we've completely run out of time. I got to let you go. I appreciate it, Jane. There's already callers lining up for Parenting Beyond Belief. Don, did you have last words for today?
No, thank you to our crew. They're awesome.
They are awesome. And the people out there on this other wall, we'll be back next week. I'll be back in, I don't know,
do we have
check
any
the
announcements
schedule.
About dinner?
Oh, it's here. It's always here.
It's always here.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We don't go anywhere. You just come right down to the Freethought Library, 1507 West Koenig Lane. Any atheist or atheist-friendly person is welcome to come down, hang out. Parking is at a premium. You may have to park around the corner. But we're here, and this is the atheist community of Austin, and you have a community here. Okay. And we're going to do what we can to make humankind kind to some extent.
We're done. Bye.